meditation. We've been great so far. I've learned a lot from all these different great talks. So for those of you who feel very tired and they can't find this, here's the archive number. This is joint to work with voluntary sequence sequentially. Before to begin, I would like to enjoy the fact that I speak to all of you at the same time. I am an editor of a new journal called Higher Structures. So you put behind that whatever you want. And we are running this new journal. We will have a first volume at the beginning of 2017. So if you are young and you're doing a brilliant PhD thesis and you want to submit your paper to InventionS, submit it to InventionS. But if you're more senior and you have a nice paper that you're writing, please consider the fact to send it to me or one of my editors to try to have this new journal. It's one of the most free academic. Our goal, of course, will not be IHCS, ANAS, whatsoever. We want to do a good job in our structure, in this space. Okay, so let's do math. Okay, so I had a choice, say, between two talks. Either give you all the details, well, the definitions, the proofs of what I'm going to talk about. I think that we are almost all quite tired. And I chose rather to give a survey on something which is quite classical. That is, we have four topological geometrical operators. I will explain to you why they are before. We already saw most of them, okay? So you won't be much surprised. And then I will try to give you some non-commutative analogs of these guys. So maybe at some point you will hear too many new words, now you would like to have more definition, please ask. Otherwise, please just listen to the music. And maybe one day, even if you don't know the definition, maybe one day in your work, you will hear the same music, and at that time, you can go and look at the definitions and maybe once again. Okay, so what is the classic definition?
You know, the brain retains smell even better.
I don't know how to produce that right now. I just told you to talk with sugar, so... Well, maybe next time I cook for you. So what is the classical equation? Here by classical I mean commutative equation. So what have we seen so far? What we've seen so far is the little disc operad, NV2, a mass denoted LV2. So here I'm considering the little disc operad in dimension 2. Okay. And so here we're going to have some geometrical or topological graph. Okay, so we have one nice topological graph. It's made up of configuration of disks inside the unit disk, and they are not precise, but Thomas gave you the very precise definition in terms of embedding, etc., etc. So then this is the mother of all operas. Okay, what can you do? Well, you can enrich this operad. So this operad is what? You have to think of that as an operation. So you have to look at it in a vertical way. That is, here you have three inputs, okay? And the output is this circle, right? And then why this operad? It's because the main theorem of Peter May, this recognition principle in algebraic topology, says that if you are looking at I know it's recorded. What I'm going to write is not precise enough, but trust me, it's the core of the idea of the statement. If you look at what are algebras over that, they are nothing but double loop spaces. Okay, so this is a very natural operation acting on double loop space, and these are actually all the operations acting on double loop space. You have a question,
Robert? No.
Just to tell you why this operator is good for, okay? Then what can you do? Well, you can either ask for an S1 action on your space. So you would like to promote this guy with an extra S1 action, S1 being the circle, okay? So what you do, you consider what Thomas wrote as framed LD2, and it was defined by this construction that he did not denote it like that, but it's actually a semi-direct product of two operators. So what do? You take your operand, and then you label, you enrich all your inputs by an action of the circle. So he denoted by circle, but circle is more the underlying S module. This stands for the operatic composition, and he defined it for you what it was. Okay, he explained it on the level of the homology, and this is a Rob algebra, this is a module over that Rob algebra, etc. So, okay, this is what? This is configuration of disks. And then you have one labeling of a copy of this one. Okay, so in this direction, this is an enrichment by S1. Okay, right. So this is really topological work. Okay, so here we are no more than 1970, and this I would say up to 1976. Okay, and operat remained in the world of algebraic topology for a long time, until people like Manin, Koncevich, Kessler, Jones, Kapranov, etc., discovered that actually in geometry you also have operas. Okay, what can you do? So now we're jumping 20 years ahead, 1917, now we're at the beginning of the 1990s. Okay, what can you do? Well, first, somehow you can try to find a space which is homotopic to that. So what could you do? You can take a sphere, okay, and you consider disks on the sphere, okay, and disk plus one. And when you look through the last one, what do you see? Configurations of n disks. Okay, so this model, the Riemann sphere with disks on it, is homotopy equivalent to that, right? And now, well, you shrink the disk. And you consider the you mode that out by the action of the projective group. So somehow, what you do is you kill by S1, and what you discover the moduli space of genus zero groups. So in other words, now what is this guy? It's just you take the configuration of n, sorry, plus one points. Configuration of n plus 1 points on the Riemann sphere, and you mode that out by the projective group. Okay. But then you might not be happy because you like to work with compactified spaces, and this guy is far from being compact. Okay. So you want to compactify it in a certain way that, well, for instance, when these two guys get one next to each other, okay, you recover in which way they get close. There is a way to compactify that. And this is what is called the Delingham-Ford compactification. Okay, which is usually limited M0 plus 1 bar. Okay, and so what you do, the basic picture of that is what? Well, you can take configurations of points. When two points collapse, you want to retain the idea of how they collapse. So actually, you glue spheres along one another, like this, and you have points on them. Okay, it's not very nice, but I hope that you understand that I'm just gluing balls, okay? Okay, so maybe this is easier. One, two, three, and it's again. And there is something quite beautiful there because, okay, this existed without mentioning the word operat. What have I done here? I've compactified, well, these guys have compactified this space, and the strata, they are labeled by trees. You see, here I'm doing a tree of balls, okay? This is an operat. What do you do? You consider the zero point as an output, all the other points as inputs, and what is the operat decomposition? Well, you glue something like that on another one. Cool, so that's an operat. That's a topological, a geometrical operat. And why is that good for? This operat is encoding the Gromov-Witten invariant in quantum homology. So that's what the main interest, why Manin, Koncevich considered these guys at the beginning of the 90s. Okay, now you see, there is a gap here. So if you go back to one of the papers, maybe the only paper of Baranikov and Koncevich, they have some kind of a statement which says, well, if we have an algebra of the homology of this guy, with some homotopic trivialization of the action of the circle, we get an algebra of the homology of that guy. Oh, that's a nice phenomenon. Why don't we conjecture that this, which works on the homology level, holds on the topological level? Namely, there was a conjecture, was a conjecture by Kantsevich, which was saying that if you go from this guy and you kill the action of the circle, well, no. If you do that by brute force, you're going to kill too many operations. You want to be more subtle. What you do is you kill them up to homotopy. Okay? You should get that guy. So actually, I proved this over the rational with Gabriel Drummond-Cole. Gabriel gave the full proof in the topological setting, and then you had the proof by Anton Koroshkin, Sergei Chadrin, and Marc Arion, Nikita? Marc Arion, is it his first name? That's it. So you have, here are my four theory tools, so four topological operators. Okay. Why are they, what are they good for? Well, they have, before that, let me do something, let's say, easier. Okay. So I mentioned the homology functor. The homology functor is a monoidal functor. So, oh, cool. Each time you have something monoidal, it sends to the same thing, same kind of thing. So here you have operators. So if now I consider this topological operator, when I pass to homology, I get algebraic operators. So we've seen that before, I think, in Thomas' talk. Okay, if you consider the homology of the little disk operand, you get the operand for Gerson number algebras. Gers is the nickname. I put Gerson number just after that. So this is a computation due to Fred Cohen in his thesis in 76. So what is a Gerson number algebra? Well, the Gerson algebra is made up of a commutative product concentrated in degree 0, a E bracket concentrated in degree 1, okay, and they both have to satisfy the Lagrange. That's what we saw. Good. Fair enough. Okay, if I pass from that picture to that picture, I have at some point to use in a crucial way the homology of the circle. What is the homology of the circle? Okay, that's a nice algebra, sure, denoted by D. And let's say we have a R. It's made up of one generator of the U1 and squared to zero. Okay, so this is the algebra of dual numbers. Here you have an algebra made up of course, the fundamental class in degree 1, which squares to zero. There's no place for D squared to live, it is zero. So you perform the same kind of construction that you have here, there. Okay, that is, what you have here, you take Gerson number operand, and you enrich all the inputs by this kind of operator. Okay, again, the underlying S module is a Gerson number operation, and for all the inputs, you put either the unit or delta. And then you have a composition that Thomas explained to you. Ooh, cool. And this is a lovely operator, which includes lovely algebras, namely Batanin and Kovisky algebras. Okay? So they are made up of what? Same thing. Of course, you have a commutative product, a D bracket. But then when you look at what this is giving to you, this is giving to you, of course, a square zero operator, for sure. And what is the compatibility between these guys? It is an order 2 differential operator. Okay? What does it mean? Well, what means order 2 when you work in any commutative algebra? Of course, if you work on the algebra of functions on R, you know what's the first derivative, the second derivative, the third derivative, okay? And but then you look at what you know, what you learned in high school, but you want to abstractize that and make that into a general definition. How could I define the definition of an order 1 differential operator in a commutative algebra? Easy. It's a linear operator which acts as a derivation. Okay, d of a times b is equal to dab plus a db. But then you want to define the notion of an order 2 differential operator. But you look how the second derivative, the favorite usual second derivative, acts on product of three guys, you get the formula. Okay, you make this into a general definition. So there is a definition of differential operator of order
3, 4, etc.
If I have time, I will record it because there is something very nice behind that. But let me finish the picture before. Okay. So now here you have two lovely algebraic operas, and of course you get here from there by adding some kind of data. Okay? And now you have the same kind of picture. Here, if you consider the homology of this operad, you get actually an enriched version of commutative algebras that is called hypercom. And here you get something which is called, I guess, gravity, but I think that the law is not fully appear of that name now, but it's there for 20 years. Okay? And again, this hypercom thing gives you exactly the relations that the Gromov-Witten satisfied when they act on cohomology or synthetic manifold, etc. Okay. And again, same kind of relation that you have here, you expect them there. That is, you can kill the action of the target gravity. Here, of course, if you do compute the homotopy quotient with delta, you get hypercom. Then, how algebraic, what does it mean, algebraically speaking, that this guy is the compactification of that? What is lovely is that this is just, this gives you the fact that these two guys are related by means of causality theory. So one is the causal of the other, and vice versa. That's it. Okay. So here's the picture. Now I want to give you the properties many people are interested in. I mean, what are the nice properties of this guy, and what are the applications? And then I will restrict to only three properties and two applications. There are, of course, many more, but if I give all of them, we will lack time. Okay, so. Which one comes first? Let's say topological property. We can ask whether these operas are formal. So during this week, we asked several times whether something was formal. Thomas was considering sometimes differential radiated commutative algebra, whether they are formal. Here we're considering the opera structure. But what does it mean? It's quite easy. So they are all formal. This means that there exists a zigzag of quasi-isor between the chains of P and the homology of P. Okay? And of course, by zigzag, I mean zigzag of operas. They have to be compatible with the structure. That's the hard part of the formality. Being able to find a quasi-isor, you just lift your homological spirit. The hard part is that. Everything is in okay. And here, all these operas, they are formal. So, this was proved by Tamarkin, this was proved by Pavol, and independently by Jean Cyril Cousin and Salvatore. There's a very nice paper by Guilhem Navarro Pascual Roy. Beautiful paper in Duke, and the method is much more general. And this, there is a an ongoing paper by Clément Dupont and Geoffroy Aurel, and they're going to prove this kind of statements. Okay, so they are all formal. And I will come later to the method for proving they're formal. On the algebraic side, they are all causal. Okay, so for the experts, they are not necessarily homogeneous causal. Some of them are inhomogeneous causal. Let's find that for later. So they have nice algebraic properties. And now for the geometrical property, what do you have? Well, there is actually a way to get compactified spaces by means of the Goncinny-Crocesi wonderful model. So let me write it and I'll explain that to you. Arrangement. we are considering the hyperplanes, which are defined by x equal is j for I different j, and I and j are greater than I less than n.
Okay, so the typical braid arrangement, braid hyperplane arrangement. Of course, the complementary of that is an open space. You want to compactify it in a certain way. You have choices, some blow up. Wow. De Concini Procesi found a combinatorial, quite natural way to compactify such things, and boom, in that case, they recovered that. Okay. Okay. And then now, two applications. Okay, the first one. Why do we call that the Gestenaber algebra? In 1963, Gestenaber found the following result. He was looking at the Rothschild cohomology of an associative algebra. Okay, and on this space, he tried to consider some nice algebraic property, nice algebraic structure, and namely, he found that, well, you have the cut product, you have a Lie bracket, and that forms a Gestenaber algebra. So why? Why are we interested in such a statement? Because if you look at the Lie bracket that you have here, it comes from a Lie bracket on the chain. Oh, and it's already a Lie bracket on the chain, okay, on the deposit of the product, which is not commutative on the chain level. Oh, but a Lie bracket in something, you have a DGD algebra. Like to consider what I like to consider the DGD algebra is more Cartan elements. Now you look at the more Cartan elements there. And these more Cartan elements encode some kind of a certain deformation theory. That's why we like DGD algebras. And here is a deformation theory of the associative product. So what we have here, we have the DGD algebra, which involves the deformation theory of associative algebra. So what does it mean? For instance, you can look at formal deformation, that is, you have an algebra of an underlying ring or field, and you want to consider whether that product on your algebra can be extended if you consider a bigger underlying ring. For instance, you have a certain product on A, and the question is, can you find a certain product on, for instance, the H bar, series in A, so that the first bit is that one, okay? And then this is encoding that for you, okay? What is the second application on which? Oh, yeah. The second application is that I mentioned the word causal duality. The idea of the causal duality theory is that it helps you, it gives you a way, simple, canonical, to deform your relations up to homotopy. Okay? You, for instance, you might want to deform that up to homotopy. You can do it, for instance, by keeping this fix and relaxing this delta square equals to zero up to homotopy. You can do the full thing, it is huge. And for instance, you can consider what I call common DB infinity algebras. Okay? So here the com part remains straight. Okay? The only thing you relax up to homotopy is this delta which squares to zero. So instead of having an operator delta which squares to zero, you're going to give rise to, yes, delta. But the delta does not square to zero. So you have a certain guy. So if I call delta 1 to be my delta, I will have another operator delta 2, so that d of delta 2 is this one squared. So this one does not square to 0. You just have that it squares to 0 up to that element. That's your way to relax that relation up to homotopy. Okay, etc., etc. If you do that in a good canonical way, what do you recover here? We recover exactly the notion of the order of this operator. So these operators are all order. I might make a mistake, that might be 2n plus 1.
maybe that's wrong, but that's the idea. We recover the notion of an order, differential order operator, by means of resolution.
Okay, that is it. I see in your face that you're all puzzled because that's not the guys you are playing with. Huh? So maybe I can use the red chalk and say where in this picture we have rotating tesh nuller, multiple zeta value, etc. I will not be exhaustive because I'm not clever enough and I don't read all the papers and that's not my domain, but okay. First of all, I want to put it there. Okay. You think that this statement is a purely topological result. Actually, it's full of rotating tesh nuller. So here, when you're considering the formality of that, first, if you look at Tamarkin's paper, you will see the appearance of that. Do I say that now? Maybe. Okay, Richard Hayne, during his talk, he introduced for you the notion of mixed-hold structure. Why? Why should we consider that? Because it gives you a more rigid structure inside which you can actually study formality statements. And if you go back to, first, Sullivan's paper on rational homotopy theory, and then the way Deligne worked with them, and they proved the formality of the compact Kelley manifold, and then when Deligne proved the Weyl conjectures, you will see that the mixed-hold structure, the core of that is that because behind that you have a Galois group action over the Grothendieck-Teichmuller group action. The idea is, if you have a certain space where you have a graded group which acts on the homology, and if you are able to lift that to the chain level, it's formal. Okay? And your filtration, your weights in the mixed-hold structure are actually the eigenvalues of the action of your group. So that is, I'm sorry I'm going fast, but I think that Richard didn't say that out loud. And I think if I had time, I'd try to explain that to you, that the structure of mixed-hold structure is intimately related to some kind of this Galois group action. Okay? And then why, conceptually, why all these formality statements hold is because your underlying manifold, for instance, compact Kelley manifold, they are all concentrated in pure weight, okay? And that's why conceptually where it works. So for instance, if you want, in this context, I like to cite Dan Petersen's paper, where he proves or reproves the formality of the little disc operand by exactly that. He said, well, look, you have a Grothendieck-Teichmuller group acting on that, which actually can be lifted from homology to chain, and he uses Sullivan's method and gets the formality in the nose in 2.5 pages. And it's quite a recent paper, surprisingly enough. Okay, now if you're not yet very excited by that picture, I'm going to add more. If you look at the second paragraph of the introduction of the Concini-Procesi paper, they write very explicitly that they are interested in this compactification because they want to understand the asymptotic behavior of the Knishnitz-Almorojikov connection introduced by Trinfeld. So this is very much related, well, now we know much, much more about that, but originally in their paper, they say that. So this guy is related to a Knishnitz connection. And Protein-Fashmuller, associated, etc. Okay, so here you have. Of course, this is the place where you have the conceptual formality statement which holds. What else? There is a nice paper by John Arne. He was there last year. But he didn't talk about that paper, but I like to cite that one because he made some connection between the homotopy theory of BV algebras and multiple zeta values. If I cite Alm, I think I want to go there. So what Alm told you last year is that if you consider the non-symmetric version of gravity, this operand is free. And actually this statement, trivially, if you know how to read, if you know the language, this is not a deep theorem, it's just the same thing, basically the same thing. You take the gravity operand, that needs a symmetric group action. forget about it. You're in a new category. What about this non-symmetric opera? It's free. This is a non-trivial statement. Well, why? Either you're an operatist and you see that it's non-trivial to prove, or because if you write it in geometrical terms, it means that if you look at Brown moduli space M0 and delta, this is a partial compactification which sits between that and that. This guy, I mean, is a pure mixed construction. Okay, so you see, this is a purely geometrical statement, and it's a purely operatic statement. And of course, with respect to all these Gottendieter, Schmüller, multiple zeta, if you look at Brown's paper, that's exactly the main object he's studying to get all these results. Okay. But he's considering more the mixed state structure of that. Okay, good. Okay, alors, if you're still not excited by that, I am very much. The fact to see that all these guys are connected and they don't have the same name, they come from algebra, topology, or geometry. Let me try to convince you that the non-commutative analog of all of that is nice too. And then what I hope, when I will have finished that talk and leave that conference, is that you will keep this non-commutative version and you will be excited by finding non-commutative analogs of all which is in red there. There should be something there. With Volodya and Sergei, we already begun to work on that, but I'm sure there's much to do. Okay, so now I have to convince you that the non-commutative analogs that we considered are not too stupid. They are rich enough to contain non-trivial non-commutative analog of all these guys. Okay, do you have any question? Okay, it's going to last 28 more minutes. I'm sorry. Okay. Should I give? No, I mean, if you have no questions, it means that I go too fast. So, do you want to have a definition to keep track of something? Do you want me to say something more specific? Because this kind of surveys can be very boring. I know. But it's my goal.
I'm not sure in what sense exactly is our associators Grothendieck-Tachmuller KZ connection commutative to start with.
I want to lie. I want to cheat. I want to tell you why the other guys are non-commutative. can we do that? I explain to you why the other guys, I call them non-commutative, and maybe backward we can try to answer your question.
Okay.
Sorry. Okay. Here, for instance, you see, you have you're working over a ring which is commutative, and you extended your ring into a commutative ring. Now, I won't do that anymore. Here, what is the notion of differential operator? You start from a commutative algebra in which you have a linear operator. Commutative. Here you are working with symmetric opera. Okay? That's why you have got some kind of symmetry, some commutativity things. Inside hyperconf, for instance, the first product is commutative. It is in that sense that we are commutative. Well, it is in that sense that the new guys which are coming, they are non-commutative in cone sense. Okay, so how do you enter the non-commutative world? Okay. So usually, if you follow classical philosophy, is that you were working from a commutative algebra, and you had things which were working quite well, like the field of functions on the manifold, and you want to change that. And what you consider? Well, you take any associative algebra. Or, for instance, what Voskolescu considers improbability theory, you have a measurable space, and you look at functions on that space, and you have expectancy value, etc. How do you define a non-commutative analog? No, you start from scratch from an associative algebra. No commutativity assumption, not necessarily the space of functions and something. So then, that's what I mean by NC analog. Okay, so how can you enter that world? Well, first, you could do something quite different here. Instead of extending your underlying field by something which is commutative, let us consider something deeply non-commutative. I want to consider the coproduct of A. This is the coproduct in the category of associative algebra. I call that the free product maybe. That is, I consider inside A a non-commutative parameter. It's exactly the same thing. Okay. So let's say I'm considering that problem. Why not? Well, it's not me who considered that, it's Ginzburg and Scheler. So they are not stupid people, so I kind of like to follow them. Okay, so what about now if I have an associative product on A, can I extend it to that guy? Okay, that's non-commutative deformation theory. I hope that you agree with me. Okay, so what you have to do, you now have to consider which. What is the a good chain complex that could carry a DGB algebra which encodes that? Well, you know that. You know that. What you have to consider is the Hochschild cohomology, okay, of A with coefficient inside that A by module. Okay, fair enough. But actually, what they found. What they found is that what I call NC vs another. They found there, actually they found on already on the chain level, co-chain level, they found two products, two associative products. And now let me denote one by black and the other one by circle, white. And this one of the zero, this one of the zero. Okay, so in this case, this is what they very naturally considered and so, okay, two associative products, one which raises the degree by one, that is if you multiply a guy of degree 7 and 3, you get a guy of degree 11, okay? What do these guys satisfy beyond the associativity relation? They satisfy the following thing. If you do the product of black and white, you get the product, so this is left point, this is right point, of black and white. And the other way around. Yes?
Stupid question.
No, it means that you follow that.
So, what is the V in A sub V?
It's the free product. It's the co-product in the category of associative algebra. So I define it by means of universal property. Okay. Okay, slow.
So it's not an index of...
No, it's not.
Is it A? Okay. Is it an index or is it...
No, it's not an index, it's a function.
As such. Okay. So like average or... I don't know.
Okay,
I have
no clue.
No. Let me see. You are working in the category of associative algebra.
No, never.
I mean, you have to work in that category for at least 20 more minutes.
You have no choice.
Okay? So now you are working in the category of associative algebra.
Okay. Yeah. Now, if I take two associative algebra, does there exist one associative algebra which satisfies the universal property of being a coproduct.
Okay.
That's it.
The construction is difficult.
Okay. You need to alternate. A that, A that, A that. So you're putting T in all the places. So it's definitely non-commutative. T is not commuting with A anymore. Okay? Thank you for the question. Where are we? Yes. And then they proved that if you consider the DG associative algebra, and then the DGB algebra associated to that white guy, it encodes the deformation theory, this non-commutative deformation theory. So what I want to say by that is that this algebraic structure there is not free. It's exactly what we want. It encodes a good deformation theory. Cool. So now we have NCBS. I think Ginzburg and Schadler's paper appeared in 2012, so that's quite recent. Okay, then 2013, you had a young guy called Björgeson who considered the non-commutative analog of that. Okay, so he's one of your students, right? Okay.
He was my master student, but then when I moved to Luxembourg, he stayed. But this was done when he was yet under my supervision.
Okay, so what did this guy do? He said, okay, again, the notion of differential operator was perfectly defined in a commutative algebra. What could be the good definition in an associative algebra, which is not necessarily commutative? So he found the notion of non-commutative differential operator. I'm not sure that you're very much interested by the actual definition of this complicated formula, right? Well, it turns out that now, if retrospectively you take his definition and you consider an associative algebra with this guy, you get the notion of NC BD algebra. So I should write there. So with that, you can enrich NC guessed by that. And the NCBV infinity version of that gives you exactly Bierger something. Okay, so that's how we got into that novel. We read these two first chapters, and woo! So there should be something now which generalizes what I already wrote on the blackboard. And it does. Okay, well, then what can you do? When you have that, you can compute the homotopy quotient with respect to the action of delta, and you find something. Alors, then, if you're awake enough, you will realize that I wrote on the board something completely stupid, which is, in plain words, non-commutative, but hyper-commutative. So, I mean, we were free to write the paper. I was very strong against that, but the two other young guys, they were very, very, very happy of that joke. So, if you want to complain, you complain. Okay, I do not give you the full definition. You're definitely not interested in that. Then you compute the conjugal of that, and you get an NC gravity. And it turns out that this guy, wow, cool! It's exactly what you get when you kill delta inside NC gas. Well, so we have that, and the method is conjugality. These guys are all causal, and of course, when you work with Volodya Dotsenko, you can't prove that an operad is causal without using Grodner basis. Okay, so we have that. Good. Okay, so we have the algebraic picture. It's coming from something non-stupid. What about the topological picture? So we are somehow doing something backward, I mean, with respect
to this. Can I ask you, what happened to these things you wrote and read? For example,
I said, I don't know.
And now with NC, you know,
yes.
Do you have NC of ZVs or NC GT?
Alors, No. That was, I tried to justify the fact that I can maybe give a talk at this conference by saying, well, you know, these guys are related to RT, and Presita values, Kisi connection, by that entry door. And now I want to do the other way around. I know the non-commutative part of that, so please do that job. I will be very happy to read your papers. I don't know. We already began to work on some non-commutative graph complexes, I don't have that answer. Already because finding that was not trivial for us. Okay, so now, can you lift that? Can you lift that on a topological level? That is, does there exist topological operads? Those homology give you that. That's very easy. Look, well, that's easy, but the answer I'm going to give you is not fully satisfactory. Look, in C Gerst, you have two products which are associative, and you see when you compose them, I mean, vertically, they stay in the same order. Okay? So if you look at NC Gerst, say a basis of that is given by trees of that shape. If you want, and in between, I put either white or black or white or black. Well, so how could that be the homology of something? Oh, that's easy. That is what? Here you have two choices. So you have, if this is n, you have n minus 1 choices. So this is nothing but, so in RET n, this is nothing but the algebra of dual number, tensor n minus 1. How can you get that as the homology of something? That's very easy. You take what? Let me take C star to D n minus 1. That's what we call as C star of n is that. Okay, so, okay, you agree? On the homology level, the homology of that is that. But that's not enough. I need to introduce a good operatic structure there, such that when I pass to homology, I get there. It's completely easy. What do you do? How do you compose, for instance, a tree like this? So keep in mind that here I label things between the inputs. Hold on. Let's see that this is A1, A2, B1, sorry, B2. I'm composing at the second base. And so you have a tree with 5 inputs. I begin by A1, and then put B1, B2, and then I put A2. It's very stupid now, but it works. It is too stupid. It is too stupid with respect to some conjecture. For instance, we don't know this conjecture that we made. Is that, well, I'm going to define for your analogs there. Okay. But this conjecture, this is the only part of the classical story that we could not prove. Okay? And what we feel is that the models that we are putting here are really, really, really too naive. You should consider some kind of real blow-up a la Kimura-Stashev or enough instead of that. But we didn't find that. So, again, if you want to work on that, feel free. Okay, here's, you do exactly the same thing as before. You consider the guy right here, and you enrich it with copies of C star at input. It works in the same way. Okay. Now the real game begins. Okay, sure, you can kill a certain action of C star here, and it gives you something. We're not able to make anything meaningful out of that. Okay. So now what the big goal in the last, I don't know how many minutes, 12? Okay. Is to define for you this. And it's quite a cool story. Before I do that, since I will meet, do you have questions?
It was a stomach, I think.
I'm going too fast. Should I slow on some part? Should I come back on some part? Should I finish the talk here?
No.
Okay. Let me just tell you that all this works in this case. Okay, theorem. Alors, these were the applications that motivated that story. Please accept so far that this B exists, okay, and it's a compactification of this guy. That is it. So, okay, so, first of all these topological geometrical operas, they will be formal. Now here, I want to say that, and I think it's important for one point. Okay, to prove that this guy is formal is really stupid. We do not multiply the elements. So the operatic structure is just concatenations of elements, purely formal. So this is an easy exercise for a student who wants to prove that something is formal. You check if you understood the right definition by doing this. You don't need any brain, just need some sheet of paper and stupidly write. This, we're not able to prove it. This we use the classical Delin-Sadevel method, because this guy will be an opera in the category of compact Kellermann. So we can use a general name. So this is concentrated in weight n with respect to its mixed for structure is concentrated in weight n. This is the open case. It's concentrated in weight 2n. And there was this kind of philosophy in this context that, remember, the Delin Sullivan is that when the mixed for structure is pure, either the compact case n or the open case 2n, it should be formal. So we've been working with Geoffroy Aurel on proving this thing. Actually, Geoffroy killed that problem by considering some notions in infinity category, etc. So why do I say that? That because for me, it was my first experience of we need to use the terminology or the methods of infinity category. So far, I've been working with OpenAD, etc. And there, and it's definitely, this proof is definitely non-trivial, but I don't know another one. It uses some Bennison functors, etc., etc., in an infinity context. Okay. Right. That's it. We are all puzzled, okay? And well, okay, I will write it, but okay, you could think that you may want, why not? You can do that. You can define this geometrical operator B as. Now, I will not write that, but I could. As a model of the non-commutative braid arrangement, what could be non-commutative here? I will not allow all the indices, but just I plus 1.
Okay. Sorry, that. It's a bit odd, right? Because the thing you had before, its pi 1 was the braid group.
Mm-hmm.
What's the pi 1 of this? It's not the braid group. So no. It's kind of funny that you call
yes.
it braid.
Ah, well. Yes, if it's the braid, that's okay. I can believe it. It's just, we wanted to, retrospectively speaking, this is not the way we found it. But retrospectively speaking, if you consider these hyperplane arrangements and you compactify them at the conditioning prosthetic, that's exactly the guy we're going to find in another way. Okay? Just let me maybe give you the definition. Wait, okay, let's do that. Blah, 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 blah. Good. Alors, we have 8 minutes to give the definition. So I think I want to tell you how we get there and the definition, and that's it. Not the definition, but the flavor of its combinatorics sake. Okay. Okay. So what did we do? I mean, it's also to tell you how operatic people work. Okay, so we wanted to find some kind of manifold variety whatsoever here. Those homology groups would be isomorphic to that. Okay, so we computed the dimension. So thanks to the Grosvenor Bayes argument, we computed the dimension of NC hypercom in degree 2k, and it's concentrated in even degree in RETN, and we found something which is K. Okay, well, so when you find that, what do you do? You do what Herbert likes to do when he's not playing crossword. That is, you go to the online encyclopedia of crossword. Okay, and you find that these numbers are well known. These are the Naha numbers. Alors, if you stop there, you're very happy that they have a name. But then you read further, I don't know if you, the students in this room, if you've done that. This is the online encyclopedia of integer sequences. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Just Google OEIS. Okay? And then you enter the first numbers of your series. So we entered the first, and it told us, oh, but we know these guys, these are the Narayana numbers. Cool. So what? And then it gives you a list of guys. Those numbers correspond to these things. And we found that in this list there is something very cute, is that these Narayama numbers, they count something, they count the dimension, even the dimension of the homology group of the toric variety associated to the Lodé realization of the associative. What's that? Wait. What is the associahedra? Well, this guy exists for at least 50 years with the thesis of Stachev. It was considered before by Tamari. So what do you do? Well, you want to understand in which way, you want to understand all the possible ways to do the product of four guys up to associativity. Okay? So you can first, sorry, I'm an opera chief. So for me, I drew a tree. Okay? So this is the, you do the product of the two first, then the third one, and the fourth one. Okay? But then what can you do? Well, you can use the associativity relation and multiply first these two guys, and then that one, okay? But then you can use the associativity relation here and multiply them in that way, or in the end, you can multiply them in the right combo. Oh, but you could have done something else. You could have used the associativity relation here. It would have given you this kind of composition scheme, and then you can apply the associativity relation to change that into that one. This is what happened in dimension 2. Okay? Higher up, if you want to know what's going on when you have n inputs, you will discover polytope in dimension n. And Jean-Louis Laudet one day said, wow, I like that guy. And I would like to find integer coordinates for this thing. And he found it by a very nice and quite easy combinatorial trick. Now, there is something I have no time good for you to explain it, that each time you have a polytope, okay, you can associate to it a nice algebraic variety. So this is a toric variety associated out of that. So it is beautiful. And actually, that's the guy that we consider. Okay? But, so, so be careful. There is maybe something which is misleading here.
But then on the polytope there are some conditions. Is it?
Yes. You have these conditions there. Yeah. I don't remember the name.
Delzon.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, didn't satisfy the Delzon condition. Yeah. So what I want to say is that now this is what we took. Again, we've been through the literature, and there is someone called Escobar who described that. So now I'm not out of time, but I mean, let me not describe that. You will see that when you describe that, you have some configurations. It's like the Grassmannian, you have some configuration of sub-linear spaces in a big space. But again, I mean, so there is a description of that. And she called that B for Greek manifold. But the description that Escobar gave is far from being operatical. These people, they do not study toric varieties because they love operas. It's because they are algebraic geometers. What a pity for them. So, when we look at their description, we said now the goal is to put an operatic structure there. So that is what we did. So yes, on that, you can put actually a non-symmetric opera structure. And that's it. That's the guy that we put here. So you see, conclude, when we wanted, or if you want to give a non-commutative analog of the M0 and plus 1, one very good candidate is the historic varieties associated to the Laudet realization of the associahedra. Okay, so what should I say? I should say that this is the open stratum of that, top dimensional open stratum to that. This is definitely a compactification of that, and everything works well. And there is just one thing I just want to comment on, is that, well, so if you take the De Concini-Procesi model of this guy, the Concini-Procesi model depends on something which is called the building set. So, will you blow up everything, I mean, the minimal thing or the maximal? If you take the minimal thing, you get that guy. If you take the maximal, you get Los Hermanian moduli space. Wow. This one is the toric variety associated to the associahedra. The Los Hermanian is the toric variety associated to the permutohedra. And we know how to pass from associahedra to permutohedra is by truncation. Therefore, on the level of the toric varieties, we should obtain one from the other by means of blow-up. That's exactly what is doing, what is happening. I mean, this is very coherent. Okay, I think it's good that I stop here. And I hope that you have a question. Thank you very much.
Questions or comments?
Please. Are you happy with what I said about ends non-commutative and commutative? You can say no.
No.
Okay.
I you know, I heard the music, but like you suggested in the beginning, but sort of.
Why?
You know, that's not.
How is it you say these guys have toric varieties, right? Yeah. Well, what kind of operatic, like, well, what was the simplest example of the composition operation?
Okay, give me one minute and I give you the definition of that. So, what is B4? Let me give you one example. What is B4? Okay, so let me denote like G, I, J. You take the vector space generated by E1 to 2, E2 to 3, oh sorry, EI I plus 1, EI plus 1, I plus 2, etc. until E, J, J plus 1, I hope so. And you do that for I less than J. So you see, for instance, here, where are my working, I'm working in G14. I'm working in G14, and G14 is the vector space generated by E12, E23, E34. So that is, this is nothing but C3, but with this labeling. And then what is B4? B4 is nothing but all the configurations of the following thing. And you will see that it has the shape of a tree, I hope so, if I draw it correctly. On that level, I'm going to have G12. G12 embeds inside G13, which embeds inside G14. Okay, I can put a copy of G14, and then this, you see, is inside G24, and inside you have G34. So you have some space there, you see, I'm going to add, well, I think this is V33, but it doesn't matter much. Okay. So you see, this is just a one-dimensional space. So on this line, everything is dimension 1. On this line, everything is dimension 2. And on this line, everything is dimension 3. Okay? So you see the degree of freedom is these three sub-vector spaces, two lines and one plane. Okay. And they should be, this line should live inside these planes. Okay. And this plane, well, and this plane should live in the full space. Okay? So let me draw maybe an example.
And this is some kind of cluster story, right?
Yeah, that should be related to cluster things. So this is what we have not understood so far. We think so too, but we are not so far able to do that. So hold on, what am I doing? Yes. What should I do? Maybe I should consider something like that. Okay, so let's say now that you choose V23. So let's say that this is V23. You have no, in this case, you have no choice for V22. That should be the intersection with this plane. So this is D22, and that line will be V32. So this is an element of that. Okay? Now I hope that you see that it has the shape of a triangle. Of course, for me a triangle is not a triangle, it's a corolla. So I want to view this as a space of operation, topological, geometrical space of operations with four input and one output. Then when you have two of them, well, you have some configurations, they have to satisfy some constraint, you can fill the gap. And there is a way to do that. And then maybe I hope that you can see that the constraints are, if you fix this in a generic position, then these are fixed. But then, for instance, if you fix this, if V23 is that plane, then you're forced to take this one. So that's how you have a stratification. When one of your hyperplane is in some top position.
But the impression is if I want to insert something on the top, then I need to have a bigger dimensional space or not. Otherwise, where would kind of...
Yes, but sure, if you're right. If you compose B, I, an operation with I inputs, with an operation with J inputs, you have I plus J minus 1 inputs. And so the dimension is something made out of this I and the J. So I, J, proof. Yes, definitely it's something bigger.
So your non-commutativization was... Oh, come on, you're using much more complicated words.
Yes, but I've never heard about this one before. It's the first time.
Was to take sort of a free product with R of T.
Yes.
But, you know, you can imagine many, many worse non-commutativizes, or whatever.
I will not be able to say that word. Okay, please. When I said non-commutative is that we found the math, and at some point we had to coin a name. We have the feeling, which is, I hope, a little bit justified, that there is something really non-commutative in cone or non-commutative geometry sense. You pass from something which holds in any generic commutative algebra with something which holds in any associative algebra. That deformation theory, the differential operators. That's why we call that non-commutative version. That's the only thing I wanted to say. Maybe it's not perfect.
Okay.
You know, names that are also good to be able to remember the notion, so it's confusing for you.
Okay. Thanks again.